Well, summer is in full gear, which means our insect world is in full gear as well, so we thought it a good time to bring you another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world, with our resident expert, Dr. Beverly Burden. She is an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. This program is made possible tonight by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and tonight we invite you to call in with your questions about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Dr. Burden, glad to have you with us again. How are you doing?
It's a good day, a little bit wet, but it's a good day.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that opening. The bees are buzzing out there. Well, I don't think anything's buzzing a lot with all of this rain, but you just never know what's creeping and crawling out there with all of this rain. Well, it's that time again of year that we discuss baseball, and, well, once again, we bring out our sound effect of that beautiful sound of a bat hitting the ball, and that is an ashen bat hitting that ball, and the ash tree is the subject matter of some recent stories about the emerald ash borer expanding its territories now into 27 states. And most recently, it has been discovered in Caddo Lake in East Texas. And as a result, they've actually put an agricultural quarantine on Harrison County, restricting firewood to be taken from the area in an effort to spread the spread, or in an effort to prevent the spread of this disease. Give us an update on where we're at on treating the ash borer problem and how it's spreading. Have we contained it? Is it slowly spreading? Where are we at on all of this?
It's pretty much at the epidemic stage. It's not a good story at all, Bill. The emerald ash borer is less than a half an inch in length. It's very, very small. But if you look at it, you know, through a microscope or a hand lens, it's absolutely a gorgeous emerald green, hence the name emerald green ash borer. And the females lay their eggs underneath the bark, and when the eggs hatch, they turn into grubs. And, of course, they're very, very small. But the problem with many, many of our forest pests is that they aggregate. They actually send out a pheromone that says, I'm feeding on this ash tree, come join the party. And so more and more come. And basically, even though they're small, they take down the tree because of the mass numbers that they have. And what they're doing is right underneath the bark is the living tissue of a tree. In the center of a tree, that's called the pith, and that's not living tissue, it's old tissue from previous years. And they're basically disrupting the circulatory system of the trees so that the nutrients and the water can't be sent from the roots up into the tree. Now, as far as control, first thing that any forest entomologist would tell people is that you need to, if you have an ash tree, you need to inspect it. And if you see thinning up in the branches, up in the canopy of the tree, that's a sure sign that you might have a problem with emerald ash borers. And if you see little exit holes in the shape of the letter, capital letter D, then that's another sign that you probably have, because the group that they belong to is called flat-headed wood-boring beetles. And so they don't exit out of round holes, they exit out of flat D-shaped holes. And there are some certain what we call oils that can be sprayed on the tree. But because they're underneath the bark, they're very well protected, and that's enabled them to spread. And they can fly, but many people suspect that the spread has been from the transfer of dead wood material, you know, whether it's for the formation of baseball bats or whether it's for firewood. That's how it's being transported from the... It started off in the northeastern part of the country, and now it's just spread westward. It's really not a good thing at all.
And this is like the other beetles that have, you know, the loblolly pine and others. This is an invasive species, is it not?
It is an invasive species. It's not native to the United States. It comes over from Asia. But the southern pine beetle, the one that you're referring to, Dendrocotonus, is native. And so, and that's been a pest for hundreds of years, ever since we've grown pine. And so, you know, the piney woods of East Texas, which we love so dearly, always has to be on red alert for the southern pine beetle. Absolutely. The forest, the USDA forest center down in Pineville are constantly monitoring and dealing with that problem.
Yeah. There's actually a song by the band The Gourds, Kev Russell from this town, called The Dying of the Pines, which is his lament for the loss of the pines in the piney woods of East Texas.
It always amazes me how science and the liberal arts and are just the arts, you know, trade off on each other all the time
all
on
the
that.
Time.
Emily Dickinson wrote a poem one time that says, I heard a fly buzz when I died, something like that. And because the first insect in forensic entomology are flies.
Right, exactly.
And so we need to get some calls coming in here, 1-800-552-8502. And the other big thing in the news right now is the Zika virus.
Right, yes.
And that's being transmitted by a mosquito that is not native to the United States, but it's been established here for well over many decades. That's the Asian tiger mosquito, Aedes albopictus. And not that I'm telling people to look at the mosquito before you squat it, but after you swat it, if you look at it on its back, it will have a single white line. And one of the other reasons it's called tiger mosquito is because the legs are banded white and black, white and black, white and black, kind of like the stripes on a tiger. But so is the native Aedes aegypti mosquito. Well, it's cosmopolitan, actually, can transmit the Zika virus as well. So it was only a year ago that we were concerned with the chikungunya virus that Dr. Bocelli and I were talking about on Health Matters just about a year ago. And we said it's not whether these viruses are going to come into the United States, it's a matter of when. Yeah. And they're here.
And Zika's here in full force with a whole section of Miami-Dade being blocked off. Reports now of it occurring in Michigan, Ohio, Texas, of course, and Alabama. Their most recent one today was there were 24 cases, I believe, in Alabama that had been reported of Zika virus infection.
Now, many of these are travel-related, but some of them are highly, we basically know that they're being indigenously transmitted from one host to another. And so that's something that we're going to have to deal with. And what I tell people is just be mindful of what I call the D's. Drain any standing water, dress appropriately, defend yourself with a repellent, especially I am a big proponent of DEET, but there's Pepperdine and some other things that can work. Be careful around dusk at dawn. And so just be mindful of the D's.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, and we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our insect world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now. Get your calls in early, as we'll get busy as we move later into the night. Now, with Zika it's spreading and proliferating, what other the one question that came to my mind was this a vector change? Was a different mosquito actually carrying this mosquito or this disease up in Michigan? And you're saying no, it's this I can't pronounce the tiger.
The Asian tiger mosquito is fine. No, it's nothing that's, the virus is new, but the mosquito is not. And that's the best way to think of it. And, you know, things are being more and more blended between the continents and between, you know, land masses. And these viruses are going to spread. Now, one thing that I do want to educate the listeners about is that there's over 600 different species of mosquitoes that actually live in the Archilotex, but there's only approximately 3 species that can actually transmit diseases, and that's the Aedes, the Culex, and the Anopheles. And the Culex are known as the encephalitis mosquitoes. The Anopheles are known as the malaria. And Aedes are known as the yellow fever, the chikungunya, the West Nile, and so forth. So not all mosquitoes, well, let me put it this way. Not all mosquitoes can transmit diseases. And of those that can, they can only transmit certain ones. And there's a lot of specificity there that the average Joe on the street wouldn't really understand.
And if you'd like to actually see a picture of the tiger mosquito, we have one up on our website for the post for what's bugging you right now, as well as the emerald ash borer, so you can get an idea of what these look like up close and personal, obviously. Most people don't get to see them that up close, so what you get to see is a mess on your arm after you've swatted it. We have our first phone call tonight, and we're going to go to Christina from Nacogdoches. Christina, you are on the line with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi, doctor.
Hello. What can I do for you?
I'm a little past, you know, the point of dealing with this problem this year, but for next year, I have some peach trees, and I have identified the leaf-footed bug, which just sucks the life out of my peaches.
Yeah, the leaf-footed bugs, you're absolutely right. There are many insects that will suck the plant sap out of bugs. A lot of people don't realize that, but one thing that you can do for your peach trees is do a soil drench insecticide. So you just pour it around the soil, especially if it's called, it's actually by the Bayer Company, although as an employee of LSUS, I can't, you know, endorse it. But if it was my tree, I would use this thing called Bayer Advanced Tree and Shrub Protection. And it's got a chemical in it that's called imidacloprid. And it will protect your trees. It's kind of like giving it an injection of insecticide, just like you would get an injection for an antibiotic. Or in the winter, you can also spray what's called a protective essential oil, and that will prevent those that are overwintering from coming back.
I think that's my problem. And I'm growing these trees, believe it or not, organically.
Oh,
I've turned out some of the most delicious peaches, but not in the last 2 years.
Yeah. Well, if you treat with the imidacloprid, it will no longer be considered organic, but at least you'll have peaches.
And is that spelled Bayer like the bear, or is it B-E-H-R?
It's Bayer like the aspirin company.
Oh, Bayer. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's if it was my tree, that's what I'd do with it, Christina.
And otherwise, for the overwinter, would be if you would repeat the protective what?
It's called an insecticidal oil, and because it's an oil, it doesn't evaporate, and it will stay on the tree over winter and be there in the spring when they emerge, and that'll kind of nip it in the bud, so to speak, right at the beginning of the spring.
So you put that right onto the
You spray it right on the tree.
Okay, before it leaves out or after?
Before it leaves out.
Well, thank you. I'll give that a try.
Good luck with that, Christina.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we invite you to call in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Go ahead and go online with us. We don't bite. We won't hurt. And it's all full fun. And all lines are open right now. So we invite you to call in right now and keep the show going. Another question. Are there any other invasive species that we need to be concerned about right now? I know we had talked a couple of years back about the Formosa termite and others. So as we follow these fronts as they move along, what is actually creeping up, I guess, upon us from the south usually? It comes from South America or Africa or Asia.
Well, other than the emerald ash borer, there is something that's called the Asian longhorn beetle, but that's more of a pest in the northern part of the United States than the southern part of the United States. And again, it's a tree pest. And you know, but let's just look what's already here. We have the fire ant. We have, you know, I have a research student right now working with the Salvinia fern that's clogging up the ways, the Chinese tallow tree, the, you know, most of our key pests are not native species. But then, as we were discussing before, Bill, there are some very beneficial, very nice insects, like the typical honeybee that's not native to the United States either, that was brought forth when they settled Jamestown hundreds of years ago. And so the world is getting smaller and smaller, and what belongs here and what belongs there is just almost a matter of semantics now. If it's here, it's going to be a problem.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our insect world, both fiendish or friendly, are welcome, and we invite you to call in right now. So where are we at on the cicada cycle in this region? Are we anywhere near the 17th year again?
No. The closest, we have two types of cicadas, which locally people here in the South tend to call locust rather than cicadas. And we have the periodical cicada that are like your 13 years and your 17 years. Then we have our annual cicadas that...
Go ahead, Beverly.
I'm sorry. Somebody just brought me a picture, but I'm going to tell them to go back into the room and see if they can't get... there's a pair of eyeglasses on the table. If you could bring those to me. I don't have my eyeglasses on. And then I can see this picture a little bit more. But right now we have the annual cicada, and it didn't come out as early as it did last year. Last year it was extremely early. But this year is right on track, and they're basically dying out. They should be gone by the second week in September, and we won't hear that buzzing in the trees anymore. And it's really cool the way they actually buzz. It's the males that actually make the buzzing sound, and there is actually an eardrum membrane between its thorax and its abdomen that it can thump and cause that, you know, type of a sound up in the tree. And if you ever find one, you can actually bend the abdomen over and you can see this membrane thing as it's there. And so I happen to be very fond of cicadas. My little dachshund, however, likes to find the dead ones and eat them. But that's just nevertheless here nor there. But cicadas this time of year are great. Of course, this is also the time of the year that you want to make sure that you're monitoring your crepe myrtles for the crepe myrtle scale. That's a new invasive species that just hit the area about 2 years ago. And they basically look like white scabs on your crepe myrtle bark. And again, they are sap feeders, and they are sucking all of the good stuff out of the crepe myrtles, and that's not good either. And the imidacloprid will do that. Now, I was handed a picture here.
Yeah, this is a picture from Cheryl Johnson. Yeah.
Yeah, and from El Dorado, and from what I gather here, it looks like what she might be having is bagworms, but that doesn't look like a cypress or a juniper tree. But there are these little worms that they're actually caterpillars of a particular type of a moth that take the leaves and they build a suit around themselves with these leaves. They glue them together with silk and saliva, and then they're in a nice protective little case as they eat the foliage out of the trees. But Bill, are you seeing anything there that I'm not seeing?
Yeah, Cheryl said she wanted to know what it is and what can be done about it. Now, I can't really tell from the picture exactly what specifically we're looking at. It's a little blurry, but so you think it's the bagworm?
That's the one, especially down in the bottom in the central, that looks like a bagworm to me. And the best thing to do, if there's only a few, just pick them off. We call that mechanical control. And pick them off and stomp them, and that'll take care of it, although that seems kind of archaic, but
if you got a bird around, then you know.
Well, the birds probably don't feed on these because that case is very, very tight.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, it's amazingly strong, and I can't pull them apart with my fingers. I had to get a pair of scissors to cut them out of those whenever I went to study them in a more detail. But they could spray just a typical pyrethrin spray, and that might take care of it, but it doesn't look like it's doing any major defoliation. So if it's not a major defoliator, I wouldn't worry too much about it. You know, many people have this thing, if they see one insect, it has to go. But there can be a level of tolerance, right. And I like to preach that. You know, if it's not doing any damage, let Mother Nature just be.
Yeah, some of them are, you know, unsightly, but they don't really destroy anything, and they actually provide something to the ecosystem. So mm-hmm. you have to consider the balance there. Are they providing an important nutrient source or something like that to some other part of the ecosystem?
It's whenever I go and I talk to the public, there's always one person that will ask me, well, when are the insects going to take over the world? And my answer is, sorry, they already have.
Yeah, I think they're about 300 million years ago or something like that.
They're just allowing us to coexist with them, right. You know, pretty much. And, you know, our biggest concern are the mosquitoes and the flies and the things and the ticks and the mites that can vector diseases.
Right.
And everything else is just part of Mother Nature.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have four lines open, and Walter from Marshall, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
The funnel web spiders. How does their venom stack up against, you know, recluse or black widow?
Good question. Yeah. The funnel web spiders, there's actually several spiders that will produce funnels, but the one that you're probably talking about are...
wolf spider.
Yeah, well, wolf spiders don't build webs, but all spiders are venomous, but there's only the black widow and the recluse that has venom that can actually cause a health concern. Neither one of them are fatal. The black widow venom is called a nerve toxin, and when the black widow bites you, you can feel it. It's a very painful bite. I speak from experience. Now, the brown recluse bite is it's almost like a little prick of a pin, and again, I speak from experience, but it's called a cell toxin, a cytotoxin, and it starts to break down the tissue. Now, these horror things that you get on the email and that you're going to have massive wounds, that's only in cases of extreme neglect. But if you feel like you have a wound from a spider that's not healing correctly, then go see your physician, and they can prescribe an antibiotic cream that can clear it up very quickly, unless you have some type of sensitivity. Some people are allergic to certain types of venom. You know, some people are allergic to wasp stings or bee stings. And then you're going to have a more drastic response. And most people, by the time they are 10 years old, know whether they have that hypersensitivity or not. But most spiders are not even aggressive. If you don't mess with them, they're not going to mess with you. And so the funnel web spiders and the wolf spiders, I get calls all the time. Oh, my goodness, I saw this huge spider. And I say, is it brown and fuzzy with stripes on its back? Yeah, that's always going to be a wolf spider. And, yeah, they are scary looking. I don't care to see them either, but they're harmless for the most part.
Are those the ones that jump?
No, the jumping spiders... they're in the family called Salticidae, and they normally don't get any larger than, say, like a thumbnail.
Right.
And they're voracious predators, and you can always tell a Salticidae because it almost has like a human-looking face. Mm-hmm. It has these two large, what we call medium eyes, and although they have up to 6 to 8 eyes, we only see those two. And they're harmless, and they're actually quite comical to watch.
One more question on the recluse.
Yes, sir.
If you don't get that core out, does it just keep on going down? Because when they bite you, you got to dig that core out.
That has not been my experience, because they have fangs, and unlike a honeybee that leaves its stinger in, mm-hmm. its fangs are not stuck in you.
Oh, no, but this it's a core that just, they said it'd go on through your arm or whatever, you know, if you didn't treat it.
Well, if
it's a core that you have to squeeze out, you know, probably pus and the rest of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, once it becomes infected, you do need to clean it out. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So it can heal from the bottom. You have to pack it all the way up the top.
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's about it for me.
All right.
Thank you, Walter.
Thank you, Walter. We appreciate it. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about our insect world, both the fiendish insects and the good insects, is welcome tonight, and we hope you'll call in right now. We have another caller online, and this is AJ from Minden. What's your question? You're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Yes, sir. About 12 years ago, we introduced a plant called lemon balm in our backyard, and it's done quite well. And it had always been sort of, I guess, semi-advertised as being a short-term mosquito repellent. And we would take leaves off the plant, rub them on ourselves, and it would sort of act as a mosquito repellent. I would like to know, kind of looked into this thing here, that there was an earlier mention with the peach tree stuff there about essential oils. If there's a methodology where one could harvest this lemon balm as a part of having it as a ready source and maybe using it when you go to campgrounds and stuff or whatever.
Absolutely. What you're describing is basically a citrus oil. And whether it's lemon balm or any other, or orange balm or any other type of citrus oil, it actually, AJ, is not a repellent, but what it does do is it covers up your normal body odors that would be attracting the mosquito to you. And they've been using that that's been a natural anti-mosquito and anti-biting midge repellent for hundreds of years. And that's hence where we get the citronella candle. It's releasing these odors that kind of messes up the smelling organ of the mosquito, what we call the olfactory organs of the mosquito. And so as far as being commercial, people have commercialized, you know, citronella and citrus oils for a long time. You can go to the market and already buy those. But it is a good natural organic insect repellent. And the balms are also very nicely attracted by it also promotes bees and other pollinators in the garden. So it's a very beneficial plant to have in your yard. Good for you.
Right. I mean, yeah, it does. I love when it goes to flowering. Yes, it's all buzzy and everything and whatnot. But I'm like I said, I was talking about trying to harvest it on myself, my crop, instead of doing a commercial approach. Are there people or places or whatever that help you kind of understand how to create like a homemade ointment, you might say, of creating this stuff so then you've got it readily available?
The problem with that is to prevent it from decaying over time. And what you could do is you could freeze it, and those oils will still be there. So if you want to harvest the leaves, harvest the florals, the flowers, and then freeze them and then thaw them out when you want them, that would work.
Okay. Yeah, I have done that in the past where I've taken clippings and whatnot and thrown them in the freezer just to sort of fill up some empty space and whatnot.
Right.
There, and it seems to work okay.
But drying them out won't work. It has to be moist.
That's what I was wondering, is if it would destroy whatever makes it
yes.
A favorable option to try to do.
Yeah, and even freeze drying wouldn't work. If you had, you know, a lot of people have these food dehydrators, you know, to make beef jerky and to dry apricots and other fruits, that wouldn't work as well. The freezing would be your only bet.
All right. I do appreciate it. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, AJ.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and we have all lines open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world. So the reason I asked about the other kind of spider was I have a pet one in my office that, yeah. That I keep around. I keep thinking I should get rid of it, but he just doesn't bother me, and I let him go. So.
Absolutely. I have some silverfish that live in my bathtub in the back that I never use. And I just let them hang out. What the heck, you know? Mm-hmm. There's no need to destroy them. Now, there's one insect that's very common this type of year, actually two that I want to discuss a little bit. And one is called the cicada killer. Mm-hmm. It's a very large hornet-looking wasp. It is the largest wasp-type, hornet-type insect that we have in this geographical area. And it's... What it does is it will burrow a hole down into the ground, and then it will go and get a cicada, what locally we call locust, and it will paralyze it with its venom and drag it down that hole and then lay an egg on it so the little grubs can actually eat the cicada alive. And that sounds gruesome, but again, it's what it is. And a lot of people freak out because of the sheer size of these. But they're not aggressive. They're a natural part of the urban ecosystem. And so I would say just let them be. Another insect that's very common this type of year that tend to capture the attention of people is a black and white, what we call velvet ant. Not black and white, black and red. Velvet ant. And it's actually a wingless female wasp. Mm. And again, they're not aggressive. They're predators. They're looking for something to eat. And but do not pick these up. Locally, a lot of people also call them cow killers because supposedly the sting is strong enough to kill a cow. But and their stinger is very, very bad, very, very painful. So don't mess with these. It's just part of what's out there in Mother Nature.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can call in now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go now to Quest from Alexandria. Quest, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, I have a question. Recently, I got a puppy, and in my yard, there's a lot of fleas and ticks, and I was wondering what should I use to... in the yard, in the grass or whatever, get rid of the fleas.
Yeah, if you have a flea or a tick problem out in your backyard, I would suggest that you spray your yard with malathion. It is a very good insecticide, a acaricide that will take care of the fleas and ticks. And then if you want to protect your dog, then there are... certain medications, go to your vet, and they can prescribe either a monthly pill. And what this does is it actually releases a chemical into the bloodstream of the dog that acts like a birth control pill when they feed on the blood that prevents them from propagating to the next generation, and you can kill them out that way. So directly kill with malathion, and then go to your vet and get them to prescribe an anti-flea, anti-tick medication to directly protect your dog. And it's important that you do that because you want to avoid getting heartworms for your dog and other problems that fleas and ticks. Fleas can also transmit the dog tapeworm. And so you need to be very careful with that. And enjoy your new puppy. I happen to be a silly idiot over puppies and dogs. You know, I have a 15-and-a-half-year-old dachshund, Wally and I do, and I still call her my little puppy.
Yeah.
You know, she's, good. Love them. Love them to death. Protect them. Any other questions?
Actually, I do have one other question. You were mentioning about the insect that was attacking the trees.
Yes, the emerald ash borer.
I was wondering if anyone has ever tried, I mean, what blocks the pheromones from being sent out to other insects that called over to eat the trees? Because I was wondering if you could use something like maybe some type of radio frequency, something like that, that would block them from calling other insects to come over and kill the trees.
That is a great idea, and we haven't figured out how to do that yet. There are some scientists that have studied on how we can block the pheromone release. Now, the most interesting cut of the science research that's being done right now is to go in and genetically engineer mosquitoes. They're genetically engineering mosquitoes to prevent them from having the Zika and the chikungunya virus, but they're learning how to genetically engineer certain insects to prevent them from releasing aggregation pheromones. And I'm a big proponent of using genetic engineering. We've been doing artificial selection for years. This is just a shortcut to breeding a bigger and a better way to defeat these insects. And so that's on the horizon, and that's what I'm looking forward to. But, yeah, when we figure it out, we'll implement it, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your question, Quest. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We invite you to call in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question is available about our insect world. And Tony from Winsboro, you're up next. Nikki, you're online. You'll be on hold. Tony, what's bugging you tonight? Hello,
well,
Tony.
I was curious about the pine beetle infestation. I've acquired 10 acres around Winsboro, and there's quite a few 40 to 60 foot pine trees that are pretty eaten up with pine beetles, and they push over very easily. And my question is, how do you get rid of them on a property, so to speak? I mean, do they fly? Do they burrow and travel? Or when a tree is deceased, do they just die out there?
The best way to handle, if you're just talking about, say, 100 acres or so, the best way is what we call sanitation. Once you see that a tree is infected, cut it down and haul it out and destroy it. And that will prevent them from moving from that tree once it's deceased onto the neighboring trees, because it will have what we call a ripple effect, where it'll just start off at a center and then it'll just spread. Excuse me, and spread and spread and spread. And so sanitation is the best way to handle that. There are certain types of sprays, but it's very expensive. And when you're talking about acres upon acres and acres, it's just a matter of practicality. Yeah. And that's why millions of dollars of revenue are lost each year because of the southern pine beetle. It's really is a bad pest. And they're so small. Mm-hmm. They're about the size of a half a grain of uncooked rice. But it takes a hundred and thousands of these to take down a tree. But that's the way it is with the insect world. They can proliferate. They can reproduce, you know.
What you said.
you know, very quickly with generation. And they can have multiple generations a year. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so hard to control insects in general. They're a pest.
Okay, so I mean, if you don't cut down the trees, because there might be a tree standing beside another one, do they have, without that tree touching the other one, do they have the ability to jump from tree to tree?
They can fly. Yes, they can.
They can fly.
They can, and they do. Yes.
Okay, so if we can't get that remedied, it's going to wipe out the pines on that property.
Very likely. Yes, sir.
Okay, well.
And contact your local forest entomologist. You said that you're in Winsboro. The USDA Forest Service closest to there is in Pineville. And talk to a guy there named Strom, STROM. He's a friend of mine. And he'll know what to tell you.
All right. wonderful. I appreciate the information.
No problem.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Tony. And just a note that we were out at Lake Bistineau not too long ago, and they had done a huge eradication of trees out there that had been infected with pine beetles and other infestations. And it was heartening to see them pull out all these trees because it was part of the forest landscape.
And they've been there for years,
100 years or more, you know, and some of these trees were big and beautiful. But you want to save the rest of Bistineau, so you've got to do what you got to. It's sometimes an amputation is what is necessary to save the whole body. So you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have phone lines open. Walter, you're on hold right now from Marshall. We're going to go to Nikki next from Shreveport. Nikki, what's bugging you tonight?
Hi there, Doctor. I'll tell you, you really hooked me when you started talking about your dachshund, because I have a miniature dachshund, 7.8 pounds, and we walk around LSU almost every morning around 6 o'clock in the morning. And everything is fine until these, excuse me, I know you like them, but these darn cicadas. And first of all, they scare me to death because I don't know that they're going to rattle like they do, and they do, and they startle me. And my dog thinks this is something to play with. And so she's jumping all over them. She's about 8 or 10 years old and has no teeth because she's a rescue and all of that. I'm scared to death to have her get them in the mouth. Would they hurt her?
No. My dachshund's been eating dead cicadas for years now, and she's 15 and a half. If they were harmful, we would have known it by now. And speaking of, United States and Europe are the only two areas in the world that don't have insects as part of their diet. In other countries, especially in the Asian and Pacific areas, people eat and raise insects. They're high in protein, low in fat and cholesterol. And so unless they're damaging her gums, I just let her have her way with them.
Let her play with them, huh?
Absolutely.
and what's her kick out of it, I'll tell you.
And what's her name?
Her name is Shorty.
Shorty. Good name for a dachshund. What do they say? Half a dog high, two dogs long.
Yeah.
Right. Well, she thinks she's a Doberman.
Of course she does.
With short legs.
Of course she does.
Yes.
Yeah, no problem. Dogs
Thank you very much.
Can eat insects. It won't harm them.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have to laugh because I read an article the other day about all of the foods that Americans eat that the rest of the world finds disgusting.
And like
I thought,
what?
I can't even remember, but it was just some stuff that's local.
It's
but,
probably
you know,
like ketchup.
Yeah, you know, and they're eating, and, you know, it's all a matter of perspective, I
it
guess.
Is.
Although I don't know whether I want my high-protein diet to be of cicadas. So give us a call at 800-552-8502. You're online with Dr. Beverly Burden, and the show is called What's Bugging You? And we'll take your questions tonight about our insect world. Again, 800-552-8502. Bobby from El Dorado, we've got you on hold for 1 second. We're going to go next to Walter from Marshall. Walter, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, my daughter, I've got a real bad flea problem. I live in the woods with a pack of timber wolves, and she brought me some diatomaceous earth. Will that kill the fleas? And how should I put it?
No. I don't know what they were thinking. Diatomaceous earth are basically ground up shells of these aquatic things that are called radiolarians and foraminiferans. And they're very abrasive, but they're only abrasive to soft bodied organisms like slugs and snails. And it won't do anything to treat the fleas. Now, what they might have been thinking, and a lot of people don't realize, is that it's only the adult flea that feeds on the blood of a dog or a cat or humans or anything else. Yeah. And fleas are not very host specific. Dog fleas will feed on any other mammal. And but the immatures of these, before they molt, before they metamorphize into an adult, it's almost like a little white wormy grub thing, kind of
larva.
Yeah, it's the larvae. And but they tend to have a pretty hard cuticle on them, covering on their body, that I don't think diatomaceous earth would be any deterrent to them at all.
Well, what would I use? The fleas are everywhere. I mean, they're just...
Malathion.
Malathion?
Malathion to treat the grass and the area around your home.
How about in the home? Because my dogs stay in, they stay in the house and they're wolves, though. But wolves and dogs are not compatible, you know, in their medicines. Because I've had stuff that kill my wolves.
Yeah, I would still go to some type of a, you can buy these gels that you put on the back of their neck that will then spread, or a pill from your vet. But again, consult your vet because you want to make sure it's compatible with the breed of the dog that you have.
Yeah, I heard peppermint oil would do that. I don't know.
You can try that. I don't think you'll have as good of control as you probably want. You need to and vacuum. You know, if you have vacuum, and then once you vacuum, take the vacuum bag out and take it outside and dispose of it.
Yeah,
and you know, just because that way you're going to clean up the fleas that aren't on the dogs and any immatures that might be then turning into adults.
Actually, I've found vacuuming the dogs works real good.
Do it.
Vacuum and it sucks the fleas right off of them, but they pick them up so fast.
You can also shave them, and that'll work. You know.
Yeah.
But no, but people don't want to hear that remedy.
A naked timber wolf. I mean, shoot.
Oh, I know. He'll grow back.
He will.
I'm telling them that.
Well, I had to do that with my dog once. He got sprayed by a skunk, and there was no way to wash it out, so we shaved a chow that looked like he was 40 pounds of all meat, and he turned out to be basically not even a dachshund size. I think it was like a chihuahua size under there.
Yeah. Yeah.
There wasn't anything left of him after all the hair came off, but it grew back in 3 months.
The hair came off.
Yep.
That'll work, too.
Okay, I appreciate you.
Thank you, Walter.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and we can take your calls right now at 800-552-8502. Four lines are open right now. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Bobby from El Dorado. Bobby, what's bugging you tonight?
Hi, good afternoon. I was just curious, how do insecticides specifically work in regards to the weather, and you know, it rains and it doesn't get rid of them, so that you don't have to spray every week or every time after it rains or whatnot, and they're a lot, you know, they last different periods of lengths of time.
Insecticides will be washed off in the rain, and also they will degrade over time with the sunlight. UV radiation will degrade them. Now, that's a great question. How do they actually work? Most insecticides that are like your malathions or your seven dust, those work. They are what we call nerve poisons. When a nerve fires, that electrical impulse goes from one nerve cell to another nerve cell, and there are these chemicals that make the nerves, that electrical impulse to continue on. And those chemicals have to be broken down, or else the nerve just keeps firing, the nerves go into what we call convulsions. And there are chemicals that break down those other chemicals that causes the nerve to fire. Insecticides block the chemical that destroys the chemical to make the nerves fire. And so the chemicals that make the nerves fire are called neurotransmitters. And so it blocks the chemical that breaks down the neurotransmitters. And so that's why when you go and you spray the cockroach in the middle of your kitchen floor at 2 o'clock in the morning, they don't die right away. They flop over it and they go into what we call cockroach convulsions. And unfortunately, the same neurotransmitters that are in cockroaches are in humans. And so the nerve poisons can be poisonous to both insects and to humans. But there are other poisons that are called stomach poisons. And these are derived from the bacteria. If you've heard of BT insecticides, they are basically, they're kind of nerve poisons, but they're also stomach poisons. And they basically blow little holes and into the stomach of the insects, and they die a slow and painful death. We don't like those very much because we don't see instant results, but they're very effective.
Well, and I guess the source of the question was, how do the insecticides stay and remain effective over a period of time in the home or in the yard? I've used some in the yard, and they seem to last for months.
Mm-hmm.
And such. And then our home, we spray maybe once a year, and we haven't had any bugs in a long time.
A lot of times, these insecticides are what we call encapsulated, and so they're surrounded by a protective coat, and so they don't break down very readily over time. But in time, they will. Nothing lasts forever. But, the insecticide companies, just like the pharmaceutical companies, invest thousands and millions of dollars to make these things as effective as possible. And that's what brings in the money. And so luckily for us, some of them are long-lasting, but some of them are short-lasting. Sometimes we want short-lasting things.
Right.
Sometimes we want long-lasting things.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bobby.
All right, thank you, Bobby. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call. We still have time, and we've got four lines open. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Otis from Anacoco, you're on line next. What's bugging you tonight?
Hello.
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 I can remember several years ago that in April or May in West Texas, at night, you'd be driving along the highway, these tarantulas and something sort of like a centipede, but he's as big as a hot dog cut in half, cross the road, and they're all going west, and they're ignoring everything. They'll be several feet apart in some cases, but there'll be a massive, migration to the west.
I have seen that. I'm from north central Texas, up in the Wichita Falls, Texas area, and driving over to Lubbock, I have seen these mass migrations of tarantulas. And basically, it's just their way of migrating. Certain insects and spiders do migrate. The classic example are the are the monarch butterflies that migrate from North America down to central Mexico. And so many, many insects migrate. Now, the things that might look like centipedes, they might be centipedes, but what I'm thinking they might be, because they're very elongated, are things that are either called sun spiders or whip scorpions. And those are very indigenous to the dry, arid desert area of West Texas. Okay. And so that's one of the cool things about Texas, is you can go from the deserts to the piney woods, from the coast to,
the mountains, really.
The Davis Mountains. Yeah. And so, if you're going to see something weird, it's probably going to be in Texas. I can tell you that.
Okay, but, someone told me that that's also something that the crawfish do in Cameron Parish.
I have not heard of migrating crawfish, but crawfish are unique in the fact that they can crawfish can exist outside of water for long periods of time. And so if they're going to move from one pond that's drying up to another pond that's not drying up, they have that capability of doing that. They're one of the most versatile crustaceans that we have. And the fact that they can live in water, they can live in dry land, you can boil them, you can fry them. Very, very versatile crustacean.
Okay. All right, well, thanks for the information.
Thanks, Otis.
All right, thank you, Otis, for calling in, and you are listening to What's Bugging You. We still have time for one more question, maybe two, if you call in right now at 800-552-8502. We can get you on. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, a couple of years ago, we had spoken about a couple of other species that were finding their way and creating some problems. The kudzu bug and the red-banded stink bug. Kind of wanted to see where we're at on those two insects and what kind of damage or mitigation are we seeing of those problems.
The kudzu bug was actually introduced into the country to eat the kudzu plant. And unfortunately, plants can propagate faster than the kudzu bug can. So even though it may be keeping it somewhat in check, it's not doing the job that we had hoped it would do. And you know, keeping the kudzu plant from just overtaking other vegetations and out competing for the soil nutrients and for the sunlight. The red-striped stink bug is kind of calmed down. I haven't heard about that very much lately. So it seems to no longer be the issue that it once was. A lot of times, especially with stink bugs are unique in the fact that some are plant eaters and some are other stink bug eaters, that they can actually be predaceous upon different species within the same family. And so I suspect that that natural predators might be keeping it in check.
And one other question I have is, given that we just talked about tarantulas migrating, which I have some family up north that would just freak out if they ever saw that. I mean, not in their vocabulary to see
migrating tarantulas.
Yeah, tarantulas, just not there. And also whip scorpions. Of these, what are the dangerous, venomous ones that we have to really watch out for? Because I know, like, you know, some of them, the brown recluse, obviously you don't see that migrating very much, but that's one of the more dangerous spiders down here.
Tarantulas, the bite of a tarantula and any other spider outside of the brown recluse and outside of the black widow is no more than a wasp or a bee sting. Unless, again, you're hypersensitive to it. And so the other thing, though, that is notable, and only an entomologist would know this, is that the fangs of tarantula are vertical. So they're like up and down, where the fangs of almost all other spiders, tarantulas, trapdoor spiders, they're vertical. But all other spiders, their fangs are horizontal. So they bite from side to side. And but that has nothing to do with the venom. It just has to do with their anatomy. And so I would not freak out if you saw a tarantula in your backyard. It's probably just moving through. And they're good predators to have around. You know, people just freak out because they're such big and hairy and dangerous looking. And people freak out, you know. I mean, even Wally, when he sees a spider, I have to go be the one to kill it, you know.
And we won't talk about that.
And it is what it is.
And orb spiders, the banana spiders in Florida.
Beautiful.
Horrendous. Beautiful to look at. Beautiful. Until you're walking in the woods and you turn around and you see one 2 inches from your face, which has happened to me on a number of occasions out in the swamp, where I'm like, you know, stumbling around in marshy land trying to find my footing.
And that's when you have an arachno fit, where you fling your arms and run screaming like a little girl through the forest to get away.
That's when I speak words that do not belong on the air and run like the devil.
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm afraid that the spider is going to hurt me. I just don't want to get wrapped up in its web, because those webs are huge.
They are.
Yeah.
And to be amazed that they take those down and rebuild them within a 24-hour period. It's amazing. Yeah. You know, the insect and arachnid world is just absolutely mind-blowing. Yeah,
construction technology at work there. So you have been listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, tonight. And we want to thank Beverly for joining us again for another successful show.
Anytime. Love to.
This program is produced by Red River Radio and made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. You can tune in Thursday, September 13th, for the next edition of Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. And stay tuned. Coming up in just a few moments here on Red River Radio is Radiolab. This is Red River Radio, What's Bugging You, produced by Bill Beckett, Dr. Beverly Burden, with Wally Derleth and Henry Edward providing help tonight.